Welcome to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio, a stimulating look at culture, current events, faith, and politics from a Christian and conservative point of view. We don't just talk on the radio, we blog too. Check us out at caffeinatedthoughts.com. Now grab a cup of coffee and join us. This is Caffeinated Thoughts Radio.
Hey, welcome back to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio. Caffeinated Thoughts Radio is brought to you by Myers & Associates, serving the Midwest with industrial maintenance products and services. Call them at 515-795-3676. Myers & Associates, keeping your operations running. Welcome back to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio. It's another week, and we got Brian back in studio. Welcome back to Brian.
Thank you, sir. It's good to be back.
But we have less Ron.
We do have less Ron.
We've got Chris producing today.
Sorry about that, guys.
It's all right. You'll muddle your way through. We have faith in you, but we will miss having more Ron.
I'll do my best. I'm very nervous.
You look nervous. You're like sweating bullets.
I don't even know.
So, Brian, how's
it? Are we going to make it through this with
this
guy?
I don't know. I really don't know. We're going to try, though. So, Brian, we missed you. Are you back for good?
I think maybe now I'll be able to work the schedule so I'm not gone quite so much.
Okay.
So, I'd like to think I'm back for the duration. And right now there are hundreds of people all crying and sighing, showing all sorts of disappointment, but...
Yeah, before in the past,
I think I'm back.
Before we tried, you know, having guest co-hosts when one of us are gone, but it was just Ron and I. We flew so well, not solo. We flew, you know, together. He filled in a little bit, so we missed you. It's good to have you back.
It's good to know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, hey, we have a special guest.
Deeper into this, Brian Myers is here. So we've got like a smart person, an intellect.
And that was Mac McCoy yesterday. I don't know when that was. Thank you for that, Chris.
I take no responsibility for that.
I think we better...
The computer just magically did it on its own.
I have no idea how that happened.
I think we better see who's on the VIP line.
Yeah. Dr. Cal Beisner, he is the founder of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. He's been a guest before on Caffeinated Thoughts Radio. Welcome to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio, Dr. Beisner.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for that beginning of the show. Laughter does good like a medicine.
Oh, it does. It does. Well, you wrote an article called Climate Science, Energy Policy, Poverty, and Christian Faith. How do they connect for World Commerce Report? And I want to just ask you a question that a lot of climate change skeptics get from folks. You're not a climate scientist yourself, so... What gives you confidence to speak out about climate change? What do you know?
Well, you're right. I'm not a climate scientist. I'm an interdisciplinary scholar, and I've done a tremendous amount of work in the study of climate science through a period of about 30 years, pretty much full-time for the last 10 years, read about 50-some books on the science of climate change and about 40 on the science and economics of climate and energy policy. So I think I know a little bit about these things. But much more importantly, the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, which I lead, and the efforts of which I coordinate, has about 60 scholars in our network, and about a third of them are natural scientists, of whom about five are actual climate scientists, including a couple of the foremost climate scientists in the world, Dr. Roy Spencer, who heads up the U.S. science team on NASA's satellite program that gives us global temperature readings from all over the globe 24/7, 365. It's the best source we have for global temperature readings. And Dr. David LeGates, professor of climatology at the University of Delaware. So I benefit from the work of people like that. We also have about a third of our scholars are economists of development or of the environment, and then the other third are theologians and philosophers and ethicists. So I get the benefit of interacting with all of these scholars all the time, and, you know, frankly, when I run into something in my study of this that is a little over my head, I can email them and say, hey, would you explain this for me, please?
Oh, good, yeah.
And so I think I can have some confidence. In fact, Roy Spencer told me, 5 years ago, he actually said, you know, Cal, I think you know all the arguments pro and con on the science of global warming better than any climatologist I know, because we all specialize in little narrow pieces, but you've been studying the whole broad thing. So I think I can speak with, you know, some credibility on this, and I can point mm-hmm. people to excellent sources.
Okay. Well, you do get into the ethics of human-induced climate change and how we respond to it. You said in your article, you said these can have important ethical implications, especially when we're talking about the poor.
Yeah.
How does this, you know, how does this impact the poor, and what kind of policy would be not ethical, and what should we pursue?
Well, you know, the Apostle Paul told us in Galatians 2:10 that when he visited the other apostles in Jerusalem, they had just one request of him: remember the poor. And he said, that's the very thing that I was intent on doing already anyway. So that obviously should be a very high priority for us as Christians. Poor people are vulnerable to all kinds of things, and we as Christians should look out to make sure that policy in the countries where we have a voice, as in representative democracies like ours, that policy doesn't pose serious threats to the poor. So let me just give you two examples. One, in terms of developed countries, comparatively wealthy countries like our own or like those in Western Europe, how does the policy promoted to fight global warming actually impact poor people in places like this? Well, in the early 2000s, the United Kingdom, in an effort to fight global warming, adopted a very, very strict policy of pursuing wind and solar energy to replace coal-fired power plants, shut down a lot of coal plants, and tried to replace them with wind and solar. Well, the problem with that is that wind and solar are, A, much more expensive to generate electricity than coal, and B, they're intermittent and therefore not very reliable, and so as a result, electricity rates skyrocketed mm-hmm. in Great Britain. And now, epidemiologists, you know, doctors know that cold weather is tougher on people than warm weather.
Right.
When people are old and weak and they get sick, they're more likely to die in the winter than in the summer. And so we speak of what's called excess premature deaths in the winter. Now, in years past, typical excess premature winter deaths in Great Britain tended to run about 10 to 11,000 per year. But from 2010 onward, they've gone up to typically between 25 and 35,000 per year. In fact, one year approached 40,000. So what that means, and the reason for it, frankly, is energy poverty.
Right.
As electricity rates skyrocketed, these poorer people in Great Britain, especially the elderly on fixed incomes, couldn't afford to heat their homes enough to protect them from the debilitating cold. And so you had a doubling and more than a tripling of excess premature winter deaths in Great Britain.
To get
an idea what that would mean in the United States, we have about five times the population,
right,
and much of our country gets a whole lot colder. So we would expect to see excess premature winter deaths triple here in the United States, or more than triple, and the result would be an extra, instead of 15 or 20,000 extra deaths, we could expect an extra 80 or 90,000 premature deaths every winter. That's in wealthy countries.
Well, and I was just also, you know, Europe has also experienced a lot of, I'm assuming due to their energy policy, a lot of heat-related deaths as well, haven't they?
Well, yeah,
in the summertime.
They did back in, I believe it was 2011, they had quite a severe heat wave. But in fact, that didn't have so much to do with the amount of heat as it had to do with the fact that the people just simply weren't prepared for it.
Okay.
What we find, by the way, over time is that when a severe heat wave, or for that matter, a severe cold snap hits a region in one year, it will have, you know, a certain effect in terms of mortality rates. If the same thing happens, you know, a year later, 5 years later, 10 years later, the mortality impact will be much lower. Why? because people learn from the earlier event, and they learn to get to inform the population earlier. People prepare. You have public places of shelter available, and so on. So that's not sort of a long-term thing that goes on there.
Okay. Your article, you're responding to another one by Ethan Siegel, and he accused climate change skeptics of misleading people by focusing on short periods without warming while ignoring continuing long-term warming. How do we respond to that when climate change advocates or man-made climate change advocates are accusing us of that when we're...
Yeah. Well, the first thing that we have to do is to clear away some misunderstanding. Those in, say, my camp, we can describe it that way, or perhaps I should say I'm in their camp, the real scholars in this, those of us who are doubtful about this stuff, what we say is not that human activity has no effect on global average temperature, that we're not contributing anything to the warming of the Earth. What we say instead is we think that our contribution is a whole lot smaller than what the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change mm-hmm. and various national academies of science have said, and various environmental advocacy groups have said. And now, why do we do that? Well, the reason is that the estimates of what is called climate sensitivity, how much the atmosphere warms in response to added CO2, have been falling very significantly over the last couple of decades. Early on, it was quite plausible that, say, a doubling of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere might cause 2, 3, 4 degrees Celsius of warming of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But now we've had enough time behind us to actually say, all right, how do we compare the computer models on which we base those estimates with actual real-world estimates? Or, I'm sorry, real-world observations. And the answer when we do that is that the climate models, on average, simulate 2 to 3 times as much warming as actually observed over the relevant period. And they also, 95% of the models simulate more warming than actually observed. Now, if their errors were random, we would find that they would be as often below as above the observations, but instead 95% above, which means that the errors are not random. They're driven by some sort of bias, whether mm-hmm. it's honest, just mistake, we don't understand this or that part of the climate system, or sometimes dishonest, fudging with the assumptions written into the models. We can't necessarily know how, but we do know that the bias is there. And then third, absolutely none of the models predicted the complete absence of any statistically significant global warming according to the most reliable measurements we have, which are satellite and balloon data,
mm-hmm.
From early 1997 to the end of 2015. That's almost 19 years. That is simply not reconcilable with the reliability of the models. So what we say, we critics, is that probably the warming effect of carbon dioxide added to the atmosphere is around one-third to one-half of what the alarmists have been saying. And in fact, some of us think a little bit less than that. I have some reasons why I tend toward that.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we point out is that the warming has been in fits and starts. There are these long periods of no warming, and then there are roughly the same length periods of warming, and then no warming, and then warming, and no warming, and warming. That doesn't fit the models because the models are based on the observation that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been rising very steadily and exponentially through mm-hmm. through the time. Don't have, an increase and then a lull and then an increase in a lull in carbon dioxide. So the correlation there is not strong, and without that correlation, you cannot claim the strong causal connection that the alarmists do.
Right, you're listening to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio, and on the line we have Dr. Cal Beisner of Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. What you talk about rising CO2 levels. What else does rising CO2 levels do for us beyond?
Well, you know, in addition to some
And we just have a couple minutes left, by the way.
Yeah, sure. Okay, in addition to some slight warming effect, they do two things. One, they help plants to grow better. For every doubling of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, you get an average 35% increase in plant growth efficiency. Plants grow better in warmer and cooler temperatures, in wetter and drier soils. They make better use of soil nutrients. They resist diseases and pests better. They expand their ranges, which is why satellite photography shows us that, in fact, the Earth is greener over this period. And we've had a huge increase in food crop yields over the period, which is best of all for the poor. Second, that rising CO2 is an index for us of how much energy we're using. And energy use drives economic development. Without abundant, affordable, reliable energy, no society can or can rise or stay out of poverty. And so as we see the CO2 levels increasing, we know that is a sign that people are getting wealthier, and with greater wealth comes less sickness, less mortality, longer lives. You know, that's a good thing, and that's part of why at the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, we're opposed to the policies that say, hey, you have to use less fossil fuel in order to fight global warming. The risks of poverty are far greater than the risks of anything related to climate. So that's what I tried to address in this article in World Climate Report. We have a whole lot of excellent papers and articles about that.
And they can find that where?
On our website at cornwallalliance.org.
Dr. Beisner, thank you so much. This is Caffeinated Thoughts Radio. We'll be back with Jennifer Bowen of Iowa Right to Life. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Brian Myers. When I needed a better life insurance plan, I found it with Travis Risvold of Modern Woodmen of America. When I first met Travis, he wasn't like some other life insurance agents that can be pushy and try to get you to buy something. Travis just made himself available to me. That was it. He told me to let him know if and when I needed anything, and he stayed in touch. When the day came and I did need to make some changes with my life insurance, Travis met with me and walked me through several options so I could make an informed decision. Ultimately, it was the best decision for my situation. So if you need a better or the best life insurance plan for you, call my friend Travis Risvold with Modern Woodmen. His number is 515-883-0029. Travis Risvold with Modern Woodmen. He can help you find the life insurance you need. Call him at 515-883-0029.
Thoughts Radio. Caffeinated Thoughts Radio is brought to you in part by Travis Risvold of Modern Woodmen of America. Call Travis at 515-883-0029 and he can help you find the life insurance
you need.
So we have in studio with us Jennifer Bowen. She's the executive director of Iowa Right to Life and a
friend?
And a friend.
Almost a friend.
And a friend of the show.
A friend of the show. Not almost a friend. You are a friend. I was going to say.
Define friend.
Can I get into what I was going to say after almost?
No.
I apologize. No, I don't. I'm curious to see
almost,
what you're
going
to say.
I would say I'd almost consider you a frequent guest.
Oh, okay. Oh, so a but frequent flyer, not a friend, but a frequent guest.
No, I don't have to say. I don't have to preface friend with almost. You are a friend.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome.
We need a little
You're
James a Taylor too. Going on here in the background.
Little Toy Story.
I was
going to
say
here.
I have a few friends, so I need. I don't need almost friends. I need just need friends. So.
All your friends are virtual, pal. Your whole life is social
That's
media.
That's true, because we know that I'm really tight with all those 4,000 people or whatever I'm connected with on Facebook. Sorry if that's one of you listening.
You've just offended more than me.
They all love you, Shane. They all love you.
If we've not met in person, let's at least meet in person. So.
Good morning.
Yeah. So anyway, we're not here to talk about my Facebook profile.
Why not?
That'd be much more entertaining. Segment.
That might be. That could be very entertaining, actually. But
He's speechless, folks.
I know, it's kind of fun.
which is very rare, actually. All right. The reason we've come here today.
Yes. The reason we frequently fly together.
Right. So basically, this has been a big week in the courts with abortion rulings, leading off with the Supreme Court striking down Texas HB 2, which, if you're not familiar, basically in a nutshell, that law made abortion clinics maintain the same standards they would expect of ambulatory surgical centers, right?
Yes. Actually, it struck down a portion of HB2. Yeah, because it was a broader bill that actually some of the things, and we can talk about that at
length. They also had a late-term abortion ban, too.
So what has stood, what was not struck down or even challenged yet, was the 20-week abortion ban. So abortions after 20 weeks have been banned for the last few years. And then they also have not challenged the webcam abortion ban.
Oh,
and
I didn't realize that was part of it.
That was also part of it. That
most
was
the media didn't report on
of
that.
Course
part.
Yeah, so. Of course not. Of course not. So that was, and actually that was, all of it was important to then Governor Perry, but he was very, very concerned about webcam abortion beginning there in the state of, state of Texas.
Yeah.
And he wanted to stop it before it started. So those two have been unchallenged by the abortion industry there. But it did strike down, like you said, a big piece of the heart of it, which was the ambulatory centers and inspections.
Inspections and also privileges, or admitting privileges for abortionists. They had to be able to have admitting privileges within a hospital within like 30 miles or something of
what does that
clinic.
Say about these so-called abortionists that they can't get admitting privileges?
Hmm.
And the Supreme Court covers for them that they can't, they don't even provide good enough care for hospitals to let them in. It's frightening. But hey, abortion access. You know, we win.
That's
it. Big win.
That's
my
it,
body,
exactly.
My choice.
Access is everything.
Exactly. And I tell you what, I've had a chance, I'll just say it without getting into very much detail because it's grotesque. I've had a chance to look through a lot of the different clinics, Whole Women's Health, that was in play here. I've had a chance to look at some of their violations reports. And it was horrific. The things that are going on there were medical instruments bound together by electrical tape. There were, and
that
I'm going
sounds
to,
sanitary.
Doesn't it sound sanitary? I mean, what could possibly go wrong there? And if that weren't bad enough, other things that they were doing without graphic imagery. So they have internal ultrasound instruments.
Mm-hmm.
There's gel that's involved with that.
No.
They would share the gel between patients.
Oh my goodness.
So I'm sorry. I don't want to go any further than that. I don't need to elaborate, you know, all of that. But why I'm sharing that is because that is what the Supreme Court of the United States stood with. They said women do not deserve better than the subcare that they're getting. Women continue to be treated as second-class citizens by the abortion industry, and it's now endorsed by the United States Senate. States Supreme Court.
Yeah.
At least five of them.
So, basically, if you've had a chance to read through the ruling, if you haven't had a chance, I encourage you to read through it because it's a it's an exercise in I think legal gymnastics. Basically, there was a standard that they introduced in Casey v. Planned Parenthood called the undue burden standard, all right? And what the Supreme Court essentially did, and good for Clarence Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas, for calling them out on it in his dissent, is they're basically they're moving the goalposts. It's suddenly this undue standard has expanded. Now it provides an undue burden on women if clinics can't meet up with basic standards because if they can't do that, then they have to close that. Well, that's an undue burden to make a woman have to travel to another location to get an abortion. No, you got to have one. Apparently now, I guess there's a constitutional right to have a abortion clinic, I don't know, within like 50 miles of you or something like that. I mean, I'm kind of,
One complaint was they had to drive 37 miles instead of 30 miles.
Oh, poor babies.
The horror. But they might change their mind in that 7 miles. So, that's why the abortion industry needs this.
I scoured the Constitution for the undue burden clause, and I couldn't find it. It's amazing to me. And what, you know, the other thing, the disconnect that I've seen this week with the Supreme Court is, okay, they bent over backwards to game the system, basically to game the standard to where they can come up with the ruling they wanted to get to protect the abortion industry at all costs. But they couldn't take time to rule on Strawman's v. Wiseman, which was basically, that's a Christian pharmacist, it was a grocery at the pharmacy in Washington State that was sued the state of Washington so they could have a religious exemption so they wouldn't have to fill prescriptions for emergency contraceptives or sell emergency contraceptives, because I think some of these are actually over the counter. Because the Washington State Board of Pharmacy came up with a rule saying you have to provide this and there is no religious exemption allowed. So you can't even refer to another pharmacy. And in discovery with this case, they found within 5-minute drive of this particular grocery store, there were 30 places somebody get emergency mm-hmm. contraceptive, which we would consider an abortifacient, mm-hmm. Which was the problem that these grocers, or this pharmacist had with the drug. They just violated the religious conscience. So, we'll strike down abortion clinic standards, but you know what? Here this case that had, you know, First Amendment implications. That's not our preferred right. We won't hear that. And that's just chilling to me.
I told you
I had a rant in me before the...
I'm saving mine.
Quick question for you guys, because I wasn't sure. Is the Texas case, was it one of those cases that had the court tied? How would the case have gone had the Supreme Court tied? I'm trying to remember how that went in federal court.
If they tie, I think it goes back to just what the previous ruling was.
That's what I'm getting to. I'm asking you what the previous ruling was.
Previous ruling was against the grocers.
Okay. No. I'm talking about Texas.
In Texas.
I think it was. I think that was also against Texas. I think that struck down Texas HB2.
I would have to go back and look at it again, because I can't be 100% certain.
The only reason
I think you're right, but
the only reason
I'm
asking is, you know, if in the case of Justice Kennedy, mm-hmm. This was obviously a very special. He's moving leftward, in my opinion, as the years go by. This is a great disappointment.
Usually most people get more conservative as they get older.
Well, sometimes that's not the case on the court.
Yeah.
Not in the court, it seems like.
Right. But in any case, I just wondered, you know, how this would have gone in the event that he would have stayed with the
4-4.
Three conservatives. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh well.
So basically what the Supreme Court just did and why this ruling on a Texas law impacts all of us is that they sent a message to lower courts saying abortion regulations are or anything that would restrict undue burden, or, you know, that would cause undue burden, whatever that might be, is fair game. So you had an Indiana law struck down by a federal district court judge this week that basically banned abortion based on genetic abnormalities, which Down syndrome children, who are like the preborn kids with Down syndrome, are the most at risk. Very few of them actually are born. A lot of them are aborted.
I believe it also included race and gender.
Race and gender as well.
Sex selection was mm-hmm. in there as well.
So that's an undue burden. Even frankly, somebody who really wanted to get abortion could just come up probably with a different reason. So, mm-hmm. you know, but It's an undue burden, I guess, to provide a different excuse. I don't understand.
It goes back to their narrative of abortion on demand and without apology.
Right.
You know, they don't need, I mean, they're exterminating children for because they're little girls and they want a boy. They're exterminating little children because I heard, I was at the pro-life women's conference in Dallas, Texas this past weekend. And I heard that, you know, not only, you know, we know that, like you were talking about Down syndrome children, and we know that statistically it's just increasing the numbers of abortions on children that appear to be predisposed.
Yeah.
But what we're finding is that doctors are now, because they're being sued for bad diagnosis, like parents are actually, I can't even imagine the heart of a parent that goes back and sues the doctor for not catching mm-hmm. a physical ailment. But now doctors in a litigious society are fearful that mm-hmm. they could be sued for a bad decision. And doctors are actually, some of them, not all, but some of them are actually aborting even more because maybe it does have a proclivity.
Oh boy.
And so now it's not even just, there's a fear, there's a, we've now created a stronger sense of fear for the doctor.
Right.
And so now children are being exterminated simply because of a fear. And I even if that child is born with special needs, I happen to be the sister, blessed sister of a 39-year-old mentally handicapped young woman who has the mind of a 4-year-old. And she is created exactly how God allowed her to be created.
Right.
And her life has a different purpose and a path. But I can't imagine our lives and the lives that she touches if she wasn't just as she is.
Go ahead, Ryan.
Jen, you brought up access a little while ago. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. Access means something different now than it did once upon a time. Access doesn't just mean unfettered. It means somebody else needs to pay for it. It's very, very frustrating because we've watched the left in so many areas of life take what we believe to be a frankly wicked position on something and find a way to make the taxpayers pay for it.
Oh, and the Democrats want to put that in their party platform, by the way.
So it's bad enough that we have this dreadful practice in our land, but they send us the bill in many cases for it.
Yeah,
I just can't hardly countenance
like
this.
We've been struggling with that for a number of years now, where, like you said, we're forced to pay for it. And I, you know, going back many, many years, I mean, we've been forced to pay for art and, you know, pornography and all sorts of things that the government really has no business being involved in. And then now it's drilled down into more impactful in the abortion industry than ever before. And I don't know, maybe it's me, but it just feels like, especially in the last few months and the next few, heading further into the future, there's an air of wanting to punish us for the videos
and
that were released.
We are out of time. This is Caffeinated Thoughts Radio with Jennifer Bowen. Thanks for coming in, Jennifer.
Hi, this is Brian Myers of Myers & Associates. If you're involved in maintenance at a manufacturing plant, you know how costly it can be when a machine goes down. And if the reason that machine went down is because the electronic controls on it failed, it can really be problematic if those electronics are obsolete. Well, not to worry. We represent Providence Industrial Electronics Repair, and they can get your machine up and running in no time. They repair boards, drives, servo motors, light curtains, you name it. So if you need industrial electronics repaired at your plant, or if you have other industrial maintenance needs, give me a call at 515-490-2640. That's Myers & Associates, 515-490-2640. Myers & Associates, keeping your operations running.
Welcome to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio, a stimulating look at culture, current events, faith, and politics from a Christian and conservative point of view. We don't just talk on the radio, we blog too. Check us out at caffeinatedthoughts.com. Now grab a cup of coffee and join us. This is Caffeinated Thoughts Radio.
Hey, welcome back to Caffeinated Thoughts Radio. Caffeinated Thoughts Radio is brought to you in part by Crosswalk Ministries with Scott Owen, who offers biblical counseling and conciliation. Give him a call at 515-292-7141 or go to crosswalkcounseling.org. Now,
it's time
for news you can use.
Maybe. We trust it will be. All right. Yeah. First up, CNS News. The California State Senate has passed a bill that would make it harder for Christian institutions to obtain religious exemptions from anti-discrimination laws protecting LGBT individuals and make state grant money more difficult to obtain while making it easier for students and staff to sue them. California, by the way, is the nation's largest state and home to more than 30 higher education institutions that possess religious exemptions to federal or state anti-discrimination laws, at least for now. The bill's author, Senator Ricardo Lara, claims LGBT students and staff have been expelled or fired based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. He says these universities have a license to discriminate, and students have absolutely no recourse. Well, what are we to say about this? One thing I would say is we could say, well, that's just California. Those people are all nuts.
But oh, this is a wave.
Exactly. If this sort of thing flies over there, it'll eventually fly in flyover country here in the Midwest as well.
Yeah, just maybe a couple of years later, but it'll come.
Okay, next up, USA Today, Washington. Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced Thursday that the military will no longer discriminate against transgender troops, knocking down one of the last barriers to service based on gender identity or sexual orientation.
Hmm.
The move, nearly a year in the making, came despite last-minute concerns that were raised by top brass about how to deal with the medical, housing, and uniform issues for troops who are transitioning to the other sex. You think?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sorry. I get this sort of corporal clinger vision in my head of some drag queen in the trenches.
Ever since President Obama has taken office, the military has been treated as this big social experiment. And that's not what it is. I mean,
one would think not.
You got to keep up troop morale or else they're not going to be effective. And this will definitely impact troop morale. And as far as the uniform situation goes, in most cases, they all wear the same uniform anyway, other than their Class A uniform, which is their dress greens for the Army, dress blues for the Marines, and I'm assuming they're going to probably eliminate the skirt option.
Hey, whatever. Whatever. This. Oh, well.
This is a disaster. And it's just, yeah, it's disaster.
Perhaps we should move on to more unhappy news.
Oh, hey, well.
Fox News. Hillary Clinton claimed Tuesday that the final report issued by the House Republican investigation into the
Let me guess. It was just a partisan attack. Right?
You got to wait a little bit here.
I didn't have to read it. I just knew how she would respond.
Okay, the deadly September 11th, 2012 Benghazi terror attack in which Clinton is accused of knowingly misleading the American public, quote, had found nothing, unquote, and that it's time to, quote, move on, unquote.
I read some of that report. I wouldn't say it found nothing.
Well, that's just it. Some of the pundits have been referring to this as nothing new was found. And there's technically that's true.
That's true.
Because a lot of this stuff has been around for a long time.
Well, it's been four years.
It's been known for a long time, and it's all bad. Do we have to find something new in order to do something about this? There isn't any question about it, and we've known this for a long time. The administration lied through its teeth about the nature of the attack. Everybody knows it. The emails demonstrated that.
Yep.
That comes out in this report. What do you mean there's nothing here? And that's to say nothing about all the other issues about our failure to respond at the time of the attack, our leaving those poor people swinging in the wind, not having the facilities appropriately defended in the first place.
By the way, if you've never seen 13 Hours, I highly recommend it. It will make you mad.
As if we're not already.
Right.
This one will get your blood pressure up even more, huh? Okay. And moving on again, this is from ABC News. Former President Bill Clinton, whose wife is currently in the crosshairs of the Justice Department over her use of a private email server during her time as Secretary of State, met privately with Attorney General Loretta Lynch on Monday.
I'm sure there was nothing inappropriate discussed.
Oh, no, no, no. This was a chance encounter as the two crossed paths at Sky Harbor International Airport in Phoenix. Now, they spent 30 minutes talking about golf and grandkids is the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, check this out. 2 days later. What happened 2 days later? This is according to the Daily Caller. The Department of Justice officials filed a motion in federal court late Wednesday seeking a 27-month delay in producing correspondence between former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's four top aides and officials with the Clinton Foundation and Teneo Holdings, a closely allied public relations firm that who? Bill Clinton helped to launch. If the court permits the delay, the public won't be able to read the communications until October 2018, about 22 months into Mrs. Clinton's first term, assuming she makes it, first term as president.
Heck, why go with 27 months? Let's just go, I don't know.
Let's just make it the 12th and never.
Let's just make it till, you know, after Election Day if she runs for re-election, if she wins. That way she's, you know, this stuff won't come out before.
Well, and this, it's incredible what's happening here. It just gets worse, it seems like, by the day. The State Department originally estimated that 6,000 emails and other documents were exchanged by the aides with the Clinton Foundation. But a series of, quote, errors, unquote. Is that code for stonewalling?
Yep.
But a series of errors, the department told the court about Wednesday, now means the total has grown to, get this, 34,116 potentially responsive documents. Now, all this comes out 2 days after this meeting at Sky Harbor Airport.
Yeah, shocker.
Now, since then, apparently, the attorney general finding herself under a lot of heat, because even Democrats are saying the optics here, to use their phrase, the optics here are terrible.
Right.
She's saying, oh, don't worry about it. I intend to go with whatever the FBI recommends, which is, I think, what she should have been saying all along.
Right.
But apparently now she says not to worry if they, you know, if they come back and recommend, I guess, an indictment or something like that, I'll fly with that. Well, forgive us for saying it, or forgive me for saying it, but I don't believe you.
Right, right. Well, and if frankly, I don't know if the court approves this release until after her first term, you know, into her first term, Congress will have to impeach her first.
That ought to be fun.
Before any of this could even, you know, if there's any criminal charges or any indictments to be made.
Shall we go ahead and get out on a limb and say there will be no consequence to either Benghazi or the email scandal?
Slick Willie's is transferred over to Hillary. She's got those same properties. It's amazing. This is Caffeinated Thoughts Radio. We'll be back in a moment. Put me on the cover of the Rolling Stone, Uptown,
down home, American kids. Is God punishing me? Does he hate me? What did I do to deserve these trials? I'm Scott Owen with Crosswalk Ministries of Central Iowa, and it's time to pause for peace. Pain and trials are commonly assumed to be signs that you do not have peace with God. Even the famous sufferer in the Bible, Job, endured accusations from his friends that his hardships were punishment from God. Yet the Bible offers several purposes of trials in the life of a believer. One such purpose is that hard times allow us to experience the fullness of God's comfort and grace to the point that we are able to comfort others that are in affliction. The Bible says, "The God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction, with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God." If you want peace with God, give us a call at 515-635-5465 or online at crosswalkcounseling.org. That number again, 515-635-5465.
Hey, do you want to take advantage of the marketing potential within social media for your company or organization, but you're not so sure how? Let me help. My company, 415 Communications, is a social media consulting firm that works with groups like yours. Go to 415communications.com or give me a call at 515-321-5077.
And we have an announcement to make. The third annual Caffeinated Thoughts briefing is now scheduled, and we are ready to start talking.
Ready to roll.
Ready to roll. Ready to start talking to you folks about making sure that you come for this most important event. It'll be Saturday, October 15th, at the Johnston Lions Club, which is a nice, nice facility. And those of you who've been to the briefing before, you know that it's a content-rich event. And this one will be no exception.
Right. Right. And it's going to go run from 10 to 4, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And if you want to learn more or you want to pre-register, go to ctbriefing2016.com. That's ctbriefing2016.com.
We're going to have some really good policy discussions on a number of relevant subjects.
And you've already heard a couple of our speakers or panelists. Jennifer Bone will be a panelist at the Caffeinated Thoughts briefing, and Dr. Cal Beisner is going to be a keynote speaker, so come check it out.
And now we've come to my favorite part of the show. We're about to share a story that is truly unbelievable, yet you know it must be true because...
You can't make this stuff up.
All right, this one is from The Telegraph. EU officials concluded that, following a three-year investigation, there was no evidence to prove the previously undisputed fact. Wait for it, folks. The previously undisputed fact that water can prevent dehydration.
Yes.
Producers of bottled water are now forbidden by law in the EU from making the claim and will face a two-year jail sentence if they defy the edict, which comes into force in the United Kingdom next month. Last night, critics claimed the EU was at odds with both science and common sense. Conservative MP Roger Helmer said, quote, "This is stupidity writ large," unquote.
Yep.
He continued, "The euro is burning. The EU is falling apart. And yet here they are, highly paid, highly pensioned officials worrying about the obvious qualities of water and trying to deny us the right to say what is patently true. If ever there were an episode which demonstrates the folly of the great European project, this is it." A two-year jail sentence for defying the edict that water might actually solve the problem of dehydration.
And we wonder why the UK voted to leave the European Union. It's stuff like this. It's crazy.
This is completely... I don't know how to even describe this. This is insane. NHS health guidelines state clearly that drinking water helps avoid dehydration and that Britain should drink at least 1.2 liters per day. The Department of Health... For Health, disputed the wisdom of the new law. A spokesman said, "Of course water hydrates."
No. Your body's just made up of 70% of it.
70% of the body is water. Hello?
Oh, listen to this. He says, while we support the EU in preventing false claims about products, we need to exercise common sense as far as possible.
Have a as far as possible.
German professors Hahn and Hogenmeier advise food manufacturers on how to advise their products. Asked if the claim could be made on labels.
Craziness. Well, more. Nah, we're done. See ya. This is Caffeinated Thoughts Radio.
Take care, everybody. Week.
Dig deeper into this. Brian Myers is here. So we've got like a smart person, an intellect of